Hey everyone! Before we get started, a quick note. This episode is part of a special six-part season of BioPodcast. We're following four biographers over the course of 8 months, through the research, the writing, the rejection, the breakthroughs, all of it. If you haven't heard last week's episode, I'd really recommend going back and starting there. You'll meet Sarah, Kate, Kevin, and Katie Rose, and then you'll understand why I couldn't stop talking to them. Okay, let's go. In the last episode, you met four biographers. Sarah, the comedian, who can't believe she's writing about Lincoln. Kate, about to publish a book she has no idea how to promote. Kevin, finally ready to write after many years of passion for his subject. And Katie Rose, pregnant, unagented, and unsure if she gets to call herself a biographer. That was spring. Now, it's summer 2025, and everyone has to actually do the thing. This is episode 2, The Work. In June, I called Sarah to check in. She'd had the book deal for months. She was working towards a deadline and had 40 Lincoln books on her shelf. But she had not written one word.
When we last spoke, I was in the research phase and had not really commenced writing. And I've since realized that the research phase just never stops. There will be a moment when this book is done and out in the world where I go, God, I wish I had looked into that more. Oh.
The research phase never stops. That's the trap of biography. And Sarah had fallen right into it.
One of the pieces of advice that I read in a book was don't fall in love with your research to the extent that you forget to write. So I've started writing. I'm handing in my first chapter this week to my editor.
Her first chapter, Little Baby Abraham, she called it. She wanted her editor involved early. Well, not to hold her hand, but in case she started veering off track. Someone to tell her before she'd written 200 pages in the wrong direction. By September, Sarah had gone to Kentucky. She walked the ground at Sinking Spring Farm, where Lincoln was born, and then visited his boyhood home at Knob Creek. And she went to the Mary Todd Lincoln House in Lexington.
The Mary Todd Lincoln House has perhaps the most sensitive portrayal of her mental illness and issues I've ever seen, in not just about her in a museum, but about any famous historical figure that I've seen. You know, I don't have a background in museum studies. I'm sure that my friends who do will have seen something like this before, but I loved the Mary Todd Lincoln House and the way that they really walk you through, in one room in particular, looking at different theories about why she behaved the way she did.
It sounded like a beautiful and important trip. But here's what Sarah figured out the hard way. Let's hear it.
Instead of doing what I tried to do, which was research the whole book first and then go and write, truly a very first-time biographer mistake I have learned along the way from hearing from people and even chatting to friends who've done PhDs, rather than trying to research everything first and then go into writing, I would go, all right, we're going to learn about Abe's life from this time to this time. We're going to read as much as we can about it in this finite amount of time that we have, aka me, that I have, and then we're going to write.
Research a chunk. Write a chunk. Simple advice, right? Incredibly hard to follow when the alternative is so much more fun.
Ooh, let's find out how did they put that log cabin together outside Hodgenville, Kentucky? Let's read about different types of wood until the end of time. You can do that, and it's avoidance of actually writing, because that is the scary stuff.
Different types of wood until the end of time. That's one of my favorite lines in this whole project. So when does the actual writing happen? Sarah has a full-time job from 8 to 4. The Lincoln book lives in the margins.
Typically, I'm writing one of two times. I'm either getting up at 5:30 in the morning and writing. By writing, I mean creating the conditions where I can write. How many words am I getting on the page? We don't know. But writing from 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. So other days, it's happening from approximately 6 or 7 p.m. to anywhere from 10 to 11 to midnight.
Before dawn or after dark. And Sarah has a ritual. She calls it Lincoln time.
I'm in my office.
Ooh.
I have some of my Lincoln books. I think I have about 40 books in here, 40 Lincoln titles, which is such a, over 15,000 titles have been published about this man, allegedly, apparently, since he died in 1865, since he was killed. And so 40 books ain't that much, and I've got more in my house. But seeing them visually is a cue. Lighting a candle, which I did to get ready to talk to you. That's a cue for me. I have to create these cues. I think it can be helpful to anybody. It can certainly be helpful to people with ADHD that say, it's Lincoln time. It's Lincoln time, babe. We're going in. I'm going to sit with Lincoln, or I'm going to spend time with Lincoln, or I'm going Lincolning right now.
I want that on a t-shirt. One more thing. In 2025, Lincoln sits at the center of political debates about how we teach American history. And that means archival material can disappear.
And also in 2025, I have to be sure to print out as many documents as I can because there's no guarantee that they're going to be there tomorrow, whether it's Smithsonian museums, whether it's Library of Congress sites. Lincoln sits at the epicenter of discussions of diversity, equity, and inclusion.
So Sarah was printing everything just in case, because a biographer needs her sources. And in 2025, you can't take that for granted. It's July 8th, 2025. Kate Culkin's book comes out in 10 days, and she's getting on a 5:30 a.m. train to Concord, Massachusetts.
Tomorrow morning, I am leaving for the Thoreau Annual Gathering, or TAG, as some of them call it, which is it's a really nice event that's in it's in Concord, around the weekend closest to Thoreau's birthday, and it has some real scholars, but also people who have sort of other ways into thinking about Thoreau and ways that he helped them.
Kate wasn't going to talk about Thoreau. She was going because a woman who is writing a dissertation about historical tourism in Concord was organizing a performance parade through town.
There's going to be people reading passages of dialogue from like Alcott to Martin Luther King, and I'm going to be carrying a sign with one of the Emerson sisters on it. I'm not sure which one yet, but when I get there, she'll tell me.
A professor who spent years in archives, who went through peer review and navigated the entire university press process, was found marching through Concord carrying a hand-painted sign. It was her first official book event.
And then there's going to be a book signing, so that will be the sort of first event I have where people at least have the opportunity to buy the book and have me sign it. Everyone who goes, and even people who don't go but have written about the Transcendentalists that year, have the opportunity to be part of this book event. So we'll see how that goes. It's also a cocktail hour, so we'll see how it goes.
A cocktail hour and a parade. That's how you launch a University Press biography. What Kate didn't know yet, what she'd discover over the next 6 months, was that this scrappy DIY approach would actually work. The tours that she'd do at the Emerson House would sell out. Tour guides across New England would start working the Emerson sisters into their narratives. Dresses that belonged to Edith Emerson, untouched in a dresser for decades, would be pulled out for one of Kate's events. But on July 8th, Kate was just a scholar getting on a train at dawn, hoping someone would show up. While Sarah was learning that research can be the world's most sophisticated form of procrastination, Kevin McRuder was doing the opposite.
I write as I research because that helped me understand where the gaps are. Chapter one is his parents' history, and there's kind of a lot of potential rabbit holes to go down because it's a fascinating history. So I have a draft of that. It's a relatively short chapter because I'm also thinking about most of that is happening before he's born. And I don't want to skew the weight of the book. It's about him. So he's already, by the end of chapter one, he's born.
Kevin had a draft of chapter one and was already into chapter two. But he'd also made a research trip to Washington, the Moreland Springarn Research Center at Howard University. Fisher had been a medical student at Howard from 1920 to 1924, and Kevin wanted to find traces of him in the archives. One of the collections he searched belonged to Georgia Douglas Johnson, a poet who ran a literary salon out of her house. All the Harlem Renaissance writers passed through that salon. Kevin suspected Fisher had too.
Wanted to see if there was any evidence in her papers that are there. I didn't find it. There was a list that somebody prepared of, I think, regular attendees. Zora Neale Hurston was on that list, Richard Bruce Nugent, but Rudolph Fisher wasn't. But that doesn't mean that he never attended.
The archive didn't give Kevin what he wanted. That happens a lot in this line of work. But the Elaine Locke collection, that was different. Locke was a philosophy professor at Howard who edited the landmark Harlem issue of Survey Graphic magazine. He assembled the work of writers and artists for what would become one of the foundational texts of the Harlem Renaissance.
And then the next year, 25, he expands that to an anthology that's called The New Negro.
Boom! There was Fisher. And Kevin was sitting in the archive that held Locke's papers, tracing the relationship between these two men, the philosopher-professor and the doctor-novelist, looking for the connections that would make Fisher's world come alive on the page. This is what biographical research actually looks like. Not quite the giant eureka moments you might imagine. A quiet Wednesday at Howard, looking at three collections, finding one dead end and two promising leads, then going home and writing it up. These are two completely different approaches to the work. Sarah decides to research everything first, then write. Kevin, write as you go. Let the writing show you what you still need. Sarah had to learn the hard way that her approach had a trap built into it, the trap of never starting. On the same day that Kate was planning her trip to Concord, I caught up with Katie Rose Quant. She was 1 week from her due date.
My goal is still to have a roughly finished draft of this book proposal by the time the baby is born, probably next week. Basically, I've had a lot of other work stuff that I had to get through in these final weeks and haven't been able to give this book project the full attention I would like. I feel like it's probably a common difficulty of balancing different responsibilities.
Her two older kids were in childcare, so she had time to work on the proposal and juggle journalism deadlines. But the body doesn't care about working hours.
Yeah, you know, there's physical discomfort. There's a lot going on.
An understatement of this whole series.
In these final weeks, I don't have a lot of physical energy. I mean, I still take the dog for walks. I was riding the bike, taking the kids around up until like 34 weeks. So I was staying pretty active, which I think is really good for my health, but my mental health.
Her plan was to finish the draft, send it to a few people for feedback, and revise after the baby came. But who would she send the finished proposal to? Did she have a list of agents?
So I really am figuring this out as I go as a first-time biographer, but I've started that research. I certainly am no expert on where to start there, but I've been looking at books I admire or books that I think have similarities or, you know, looking to see who published them.
Figuring it out as she goes. And when I asked if she'd reached out to people in the CUNY program who could help, people who'd published group biographies?
That's honestly something that I really also should do. Yeah, I probably am not thinking as carefully as I could yet about like people I know who have done this before, who have might have some feedback. There's definitely some people who have gone through this program.
Here's what struck me about this conversation. Sarah has a book deal and an editor and a deadline, and she still couldn't make herself start writing. Kate has a finished book and no idea what comes next. Kevin has decades of research and a method that works. But Katie Rose has the most on her plate of anybody in this series, and she's making the fewest excuses. She's not paralyzed by imposter syndrome or procrastinating with beautiful research trips. She's just running out of hours in the day. So, we've got four biographers with four very different summers. Sarah discovered that research is a beautiful, seductive trap and invented a ritual called Lincoln Time to fight her way through it. Kate got on a 5:30 a.m. train and carried a sign through Concord. Her book was about to enter the world. Kevin went to Howard. One dead end, but two leads. He went home and kept writing. And Katie Rose, 1 week from her due date, low on energy, but still working. She was figuring it out as she goes. Next time, the business. Sarah's editor gives her advice so good she prints it out in a giant font. Kate learns her university press won't tell her how many copies were sold. Kevin confronts a publishing industry that has a problem nobody wants to name. And Katie Rose starts cold pitching agents. The romance is over. Now it gets real. Four Paths, One Impossible Dream is a production of BioPodcast and Biographers International Organization. Ellie and Marie Fillengaines created our theme music. Carolyn Van Putten is our assistant producer. Sheree Newman is our engineer, and Sonia Williams is our executive producer. I'm Jenny Skoog. Special thanks to Sarah Benincasa, Kate Culkin, Kevin McRuder, and Katie Rose Quant for letting me into their lives and their work. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org.